You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the 31st annual Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is a combined issue which covers December of 2024 and January of 2025, and this is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of All Her Own by Lily Annalick. To friend Peggy LaViolette, she wrote, "Bob and I are getting along fairly well, but I want to get away from California and school and my family and Bob and make something all my own." And not for long. Joan was in New York working at Vogue, but she'd come home to visit her family, to visit me often, said Widener. I'd pick her up at the airport in San Francisco and drive her to Sacramento. I'd done this, I don't know how many times, 4, 5, 6. The last time, I did like I'd always done. I parked next to the garage at her parents' place, and Joan and I were standing there talking, and she started telling me about the sexual experience she'd had with this guy. Noel, I guess. Effing, that was the word she used, the only time she ever used that word in my presence. And I could see from her face that she'd really, really enjoyed it. Now, I haven't told this to many people, but she said to me, when it was over, she meant the sex, he slapped me on the ass. And she loved that. I was seriously stunned. Joan and I had been together for so long, we did all kinds of sexual touching, but we'd never had sexual intercourse. I believed that sex before marriage was the wrong thing to do, that I'd be spoiling the girl. So Joan and I had lots of fun together, but no sex. Anyway, after that conversation, I didn't try to contact her. She told me that story to let me know it was over, and it was over. I never saw her again. I was devastated. Having cut ties with the boy back home, Joan was now free to pursue a relationship with a man of the world. In the photos, an affair to remember. Noel Parmentel Jr.'s Tulane University yearbook photo. Didion with Widener in Berkeley, California. And Didion in San Francisco in 1955. It was easy for Joan to fall in love with Parmentel. He was insolent, reckless, unafraid, self-inventing, with an excess of vitality and authority. "I was the most romantic figure in the world to Joan," he said, then added with a laugh, "That's her line, by the way, not mine." It wasn't easy, however, for Joan to be in love with Parmentel. He was turbulent, caustic, wayward, his only constant, unpredictability. I might call Joan and tell her I was on my way over, and then show up 2 weeks later. I think I was dependable when it came to what I regard as the big things, but I wasn't worth a damn 9 to 5. And any woman who believed he'd forsake all others was setting herself up for a letdown. Noel romanced every woman he met, said Wakefield. He was a ladies' man. Joan might have been his number one, but she wasn't his only one, and he could be just awful with women. He and I would be at a party, and he'd find the weak point of some woman, and then he'd go after her until she was in tears. He was the classic example of a man who attracted women by insulting them. Joan, though, was hooked on Parmentel, in spite of his occasional cruelty, because of his occasional cruelty, which had for her, I suspect, an erotic charge. She wouldn't give him up. He was her first mentor, her first lover, her first everything, said Wakefield. Her first promoter, too. Noel's the one who told me about Joan, because Noel was telling everyone about Joan, said Wakefield. The correspondent from Vogue is what Murray Kempton, editor of the New Republic, called her. She was writing these wonderful pieces for Vogue. But I wasn't looking at Vogue, so I had no idea how brilliant she was. Noel gave me some of her work and said, "Read it. You'll love her writing." He was like a super agent. He'd just go up to people and make the case for Joan until they listened. He really made it happen for her. Crucial, since she wasn't going to make it happen for herself. It wasn't that the men Joan was working with underrated her, said Parmentel. It was that they didn't notice her. I called her Mouse because she was so small, so quiet, timorous, really. But my God, was she ambitious. She worked 28 hours a day. One sentence, which was already almost perfect, she wrote again, and she wrote again, and she wrote again. She was compulsive, but not stupidly compulsive. The sentence was always better the next time. I was the most important person in Joan's life, Joan's career. I knew everything and everybody. She knew everything and nobody. And so I introduced her to people who were useful to her. People like Bill Buckley, editor of the Conservative Weekly, the National Review, and she performed beautifully, as you would expect. In fact, it was Buckley who gave Joan her start, putting her writing in his magazine. "Before I got my first byline at Vogue," said Joan in 1992, "I was sending things to other magazines. The first piece I ever published was about a quiz show I'd been on. I sent it to the reporter first and got a nice note back, but they didn't take it. Then Noel, who had written for the National Review, sent it to NR, and they published it." And Parmentel was getting Joan's name in print in more ways than one. For the August 1962 issue of Esquire, he wrote a waspish piece about the literary establishment. "The Acne and the Ecstasy," he titled it, to a list that included Ezra Pound, W.H. Auden, and Evelyn Waugh, he added Joan, along with a capsule description. Joan Didion, the fantastically brilliant writer and Vogue editor, who at 26 is one of the most formidable little creatures heard in the land since the young Mary McCarthy. Nor were Parmentel's efforts on Joan's behalf limited to magazines. Somebody once said, "I was to Joan what Boswell was to Dr. Johnson," and it's true. I got her first novel, Run River, published. That book was turned down by everybody. Joan took it hard. She cried for 1 week, for 2 weeks, a fortnight. It really messed her up. Finally, I said to her, "You've got to cut this out. Let me see what I can do." I took the book to Ashbel Green, the greatest editor since Maxwell Perkins, and he gave it to Judith Jones, Knopf editor, who passed on it, which I never let Ash forget. Then I said, "I'm going to try Ivan Obolensky of Ivan Obolensky Incorporated," and Ivan fell for it. Now, every Russian says he's a prince, but Ivan really was one, or would have been one if he'd stayed in Russia. He didn't want to publish Joan's book, didn't like it or understand it, but then neither did anyone else. I just sort of nagged him into it. "Buy the thing," I told him. "It's breaking her heart." Ivan was lukewarm at best about Joan's novel, said Wakefield, but Noel knew he could bludgeon Ivan into buying it, and that's exactly what he did. Joan dedicated Run River to Parmentel, though readers wouldn't know it. "For my family and for N," she wrote. He forbade her from claiming him in a more direct way. "Originally, she used my whole name," he said. "I told her just N, because I preferred to remain private." For somebody who did as many newsworthy things as I did back then, privacy was an unreasonable request, but I made it anyway. Didn't matter, of course. Everyone knew I was N. Norman Mailer and I were great friends. We were amused by one another's outrages, I think. I was writing for the Mike Wallace Interview television show, 1957 to 1960, and I booked Norman as a guest. A short while later, he invited me over to his apartment for a party. It was the one where he stabbed his wife, Adele, though I missed that part. Allen Ginsberg and I left early. Too many mean drunks. And Norman was showing off his muscles. And did you know that I was the one who invented Norman's candidacy? That's right. It was Jack Newfield, journalist, and I who suggested he run for mayor of New York. Vote the rascals in. That was our slogan. Gloria Steinem was going to run as his controller, but then she got cold feet. Anyway, Norman used to say that he was in. It was sort of a joke between us. Next photos, portrait of an artist. Didion's first novel, Run River, 1963, published with help from Parmentel. On the set of Maidstone, directed by Norman Mailer. Run River was written for Parmentel. Run River was also written about Parmentel. He's Ryder Channing, the book's heartthrob and arch-villain. Ryder is an adventurer, a smooth-talking, down-at-heel southerner who conveys the distinct impression that he can live by his wits alone. Ryder is, as well, a dandy, a lush, a scoundrel, a brute, and by the story's end, a corpse, shot by the husband of his lover, Lily Knight McClellan. Lily can't keep away from Ryder. That doesn't mean that she likes him, though, or even respects him. How could she? He's a man of magnetism, but no principles. That's me, Ryder Channing, said Parmentel lightly. Maybe so, but Ryder is Parmentel, stripped of his redeeming features, nobility of spirit, and disinterested generosity among them, his irredeemable ones expanded and distorted. If it's a portrait, it's strictly of his bad side. I ask him whether he and Joan ever talked about Ryder. He replied, I didn't say anything to Joan about Ryder Channing, and Joan didn't say anything to me about Ryder Channing. I tried to ignore the situation. I didn't like what she was doing, except I figured it's an author's right to use people she knows. To use or abuse. It isn't much of a stretch to see Ryder as Joan revenging herself on Parmentel. In art, she could control him, punish him. He was at her mercy. Setting words on paper is the tactic of a secret bully, she once wrote. In life, it was the other way around. Or so it must have felt to her. She wanted him to drink less, write more. Joan did what she could to get me sober and behind a typewriter, he said, both hopeless causes. She wanted him to give her a baby. In her 2011 memoir, Blue Nights, she flashes back to December 1958, a panicked visit to the Vogue doctor. She was afraid she was pregnant. A rabbit test confirmed her fear. The next day, she started bleeding and then couldn't stop crying. The tears, to her surprise, were not from relief. I thought I was regretting having missed this interesting moment in Havana. Editor's note, in the 50s, Havana was known as an abortion destination, but it turned out the surge had hit, and what I was regretting was not having the baby, she wrote. In late 1958, Joan was with Parmentel. That it was his baby she was carrying, miscarrying, seems certain. Above all, she wanted him to marry her. Joan was like a southern girl about being married, he said. You know, if you aren't married by 18, you're an old maid. And Joan wanted children. She was choked up about that. But I'd already been married, and I'd had children, and I'd messed that up. One of my lines to women was, get married? No, no, I've tried that. Parmentel sounded like he was joking. He wasn't. He was serious. And one night, he made Joan understand how serious. Afterward, he stopped by Wakefield's place. I was in a 3-story walk-up on Jones Street, said Wakefield. I heard Noel clomping up the stairs. He told me he'd said something to Joan like, there's not going to be a baby makes 3, or you'd be so nice to come home to. He gave it to her straight. No marriage. And that was it for the romance. They were done. He said she went to pieces. In her swan song to New York, Goodbye to All That, Joan detailed what going to pieces over Parmentil looked like. It was very bad when I was 28, she wrote. I cut myself off from the one person who was closer to me than any other. I cried until I was not even aware when I was crying and when I was not. Cried in elevators and in taxis and in Chinese laundries. And when I went to the doctor, he said only that I seemed to be depressed and should see a specialist. He wrote down a psychiatrist's name and address for me, but I did not go. Instead, I got married. Not to Parmentil, obviously, as he was the one she cut herself off from, the reason for her weeping, her depression. Though at the same time, absolutely to Parmentil. I introduced Joan to Greg, Parmentil said. That's what John Donne was calling himself in those days, Greg. The furthest thing from Joan's mind was marrying Greg, I can tell you that. But I suggested Greg as a possible husband for her. More than suggested. According to Wakefield, Parmentel's exact words to Joan were, this is the guy you ought to marry. Wakefield, Noel said to me, it's time for Joan to get married. I found a guy and told her what I thought she should do. I liked Greg, said Parmentil. He'd write down the things I said, and when I'd ask him what he was doing, he'd say, so I can remember. I'd read his stuff in Time. Dunn was a staff writer at the magazine, and I thought he was a pretty good writer. I didn't think he was great, but pretty good, and I thought he was bright, not brilliant, but bright. He was a good catch for Joan, I felt. He was a gentleman, semi-rich, from a good family. The Dunns were the Kennedys of Hartford, you know, knew his way around the Ivy League circuit. Also, he'd be at the breakfast table every morning, something I'd never be. That was Parmentil on Dunn. Now, for Dunn on Parmentil, from the introduction to Dunn's collection, Quintana and Friends. When I arrived in New York in 1956, I was the quintessential Ivy League graduate, a receptacle of received wisdom, a memory drama, fashionable and right-minded and untested opinion. I met Noel at a party. He insulted the hostess and most of the guests and left. It still takes my breath away when I think of that evening. He was like a stick of unstable dynamite, socially irresponsible, a respecter of no race or tradition or station. He was also smart as hell. I was soft, and he became the D.I. of my intellectual boot camp, a professor of life itself. I must love him, Norman Mailer once told me, otherwise I'd kill him. I feel much the same way. This description was written in 1978, Dunn, a grizzled 46, but it sounds as if it were written by a moony-eyed adolescent. It has none of Joan's ambivalence or hostility. It is hero worship without sigh or blush. What, I wonder, was going through Joan's mind when she consented to let the man she loved fob her off on his little buddy, his sidekick and flunky and second banana, a man she didn't love? Why, I say, Joan didn't love Dunn, because Joan said it. In 1967, she wrote of the apparently bottomless gulf between what we say we want and what we do want, between what we officially admire and secretly desire, between, in the largest sense, the people we marry and the people we love. It's a wildly revealing statement, and she delivers it almost as a throwaway. Blink and you miss it. She's telling readers that Dunn is the person she married, Parmentil, because who else, the person she loved. Parmentil offered a possible motive. Joan was the way she was. She was so tiny, just miniature and super shy. She couldn't put herself forward. She needed someone to do that for her. And look, as far as pushing Joan is concerned, I'm the once and future All-American. Without me, there might never have been a Joan Didion. I invented Joan Didion. That's why her father, Colonel Didion, liked me and was grateful to me. And before me, there was her brother, Jimmy, pushing for her, Then Greg pushed for her. Greg certainly did his share. Dunn was an acolyte of Parmentel's and therefore knew the deal, all the ways in which Joan required cosseting and coddling. He could be counted on to take over as her custodian, since he'd been de facto groomed for the job. And maybe there was for Joan something irresistible about the idea of giving herself to a man she didn't love, because the man she did love told her to. It was a chance to stoke the fires of her romantic masochism, to play Ingrid Bergman in the final scene of Casablanca, letting Humphrey Bogart tell her they'd always have Paris before shoving her into the arms of Paul Henreid. And On Self-Respect, written for the August 1961 issue of Vogue, Joan described her ideal man as a cross between Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca and one of the Murchisons, Dallas businessmen, in a proxy fight. Run River was released in the spring of 1963. It didn't get much of a reception, just a few scattered and unimportant reviews. If Ashbel Green had listened to me, if Knopf had brought out Run River, it would have made a huge difference in the way the book was treated, said Parmentel. Ivan Obolensky wasn't seen as serious. He was seen as a rich boy with the money to form a publishing company. I told Joan she'd written a great American novel. Let's just say the critics weren't crying. Let's just say the critics weren't saying about it what I was saying about it. She was more or less dismissed. And I've already told you how hard she took things. Joan was thus twice disappointed in love and literature. New York must have felt like a failure to her, to have come so close and then not to have made it. She needed to get away from Parmentel, from the city. In 1964, it was on to Dunn. They married in January and on to Los Angeles. They began renting a house in the Palos Verdes Peninsula in June. Joan, in later years, when talking about her early years, gave the impression of one long, near frictionless ascent. Berkeley to Vogue to a marriage that would become among the most revered in American letters, to a first book that made her legitimate to a second book, 1968's Slouching Towards Bethlehem, that made her famous. In Griffin Dunn's 2017 documentary, Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold, is footage of a joint interview of Joan and Dunn. To the camera, Dunn, who so often served as Joan's mouthpiece, says, "Slouching was reviewed by someone in the New York Times. Then to Joan, boom, all of a sudden you were a figure. Every step had been a step in the right direction. No wrong turns or dead ends. Certainly no benevolent eminence to help her along the way. She'd done it on her own." That simply wasn't so. Joan suffered the usual indignities of a young writer. A first manuscript that was kicked from house to house, going begging, and only after an older man, a boyfriend Svengali, took it on, which he did out of pity, to stop her from blubbering, was it bought, and then as a favor to him. And when it finally was published, it was assessed carelessly, crudely, tossed aside. She'd admit to getting rejected. Run River got turned down by 12 publishers, she said in a 2000 C-SPAN interview, but not to getting assistance. She declined to mention in the C-SPAN interview that Noel Parmentel was the reason the 13th publisher said yes. Joan suffered the usual indignities of a young woman as well. Her first adult love affair was a heartache and a humiliation. She'd admit to shedding tears over the end of her romance with Parmentel. And goodbye to all that, she cried, you'll remember, in the unlikeliest of places. But not that it was Parmentel who ended the romance. She claimed, you'll also remember, that it was she who cut herself off from him. What's more, Joan's self-presentation was undirected, unsure. She didn't yet know how to be herself, that is, how to perform herself in the world, how to pair up with someone who'd augment her rather than overshadow, how to turn a gaucherie, her crippling shyness, into a style, go from mouse to Mona Lisa. That was about to change. Murder at Hammersmith Farm. 2 months before his assassination, John and Jackie Kennedy wrote, directed, and acted in a James Bond-inspired home movie in which the president was killed. Vanity Fair reveals the story behind the spoof, along with never-before-seen footage from that day by James Robinault. Opening photo, For Their Eyes Only, In September 1963, White House photographer Robert Knudsen filmed a short spy comedy in and around the summer home of Jacqueline Kennedy's family, Hammersmith Farm, shown here that year. That weekend, Knudsen also took footage of President John F. Kennedy, also pictured here, aboard the Honey Fitz. The summer of 1963 was marked by political upheaval. Civil rights leader Medgar Evers was murdered in Mississippi. Martin Luther King Jr. addressed an overflow crowd at the historic March on Washington. The Ku Klux Klan planted a bomb inside Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, killing four schoolgirls. Amid the tumult and tragedy, much of the nation looked for guidance and stability from a charismatic young president who had just begun to focus on what would become a cornerstone of his and Vice President Lyndon Johnson's legacy, the 1964 Civil Rights Act. After 2.5 years in office, John F. Kennedy seemed in sync with the times and destined for a second term. The string of politically charged assassinations that would convulse the country over the course of the decade were largely in the offing, despite the ominous pall cast by the Evers slaying. To many Americans, the assassination of an American president was inconceivable, a product of another era. William McKinley had been killed in 1901. Kennedy, however, was under no such illusion. In his imaginings, his murder was entirely plausible, and the largely untold story of a long-lost home movie made by the President and First Lady on the last weekend of the summer, a film in which JFK play-acted his own assassination, is worth revisiting amid the current disarray in the Secret Service and Donald Trump's recent brushes with would-be assassins, if only to see how far the country has come since those waning days of American innocence. Next photos, call my agents. For one scene, director Jackie had members of the Secret Service pretend to have just heard gunshots, prompting them to rush over to the family quarters at Hammersmith Farm. A visit to the website of the John F. Kennedy Library reveals a silent motion picture, some 16 minutes long, shot on the weekend of September 21st and 22nd, 1963. The footage depicts scenes of Kennedy, his family, and a few friends at various locations around Newport, Rhode Island, including Hammersmith Farm, the childhood home of First Lady Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy. In one of the film's vignettes, taken that Saturday, JFK sits in the captain's chair on the aft deck of the presidential yacht, the Honey Fitz, reading the palms of Anita Faye, spouse of JFK's wartime buddy and Undersecretary of the Navy, Paul Red Faye. Kennedy then displays his own palms for the couple, interpreting his lifelines. What did he see? What did he say? In fact, 2 months later, on November 22nd, the president would be assassinated. Remarkable as this home movie is, what came after it ends takes one's breath away. Footage that has not seen the light of day until now. Chief photographer's mate, Robert L. Knudsen, a sailor assigned to the White House, had accompanied the first family to film the weekend's activities on a 16-millimeter camera. He had also been asked by Jackie Kennedy to capture the presidential party on the Honey Fitz and then follow them back to Hammersmith Farm, along with the Secret Service, to document a spoof murder of JFK as part of a homemade spy thriller she and the president had devised. I first learned of the movie from Paul Landis, the First Lady's Secret Service agent, who last year released a memoir, The Final Witness. In his book, as I described in Vanity Fair a year ago, Landis made the explosive disclosure that on the day of Kennedy's assassination, he had discovered an intact bullet in the presidential limo. At one point, Landis told me that in the 1963, he had taken part in a prank movie about an assassination. I didn't really absorb what he was describing, but I filed it away. He was unsure of the date. I wondered privately, though, why would a Secret Service agent be asked to take part in a film satirizing such a horrific act? In a recent investigation for Vanity Fair, however, I was able to uncover footage from the film, confirm that the event Landis recounted did, in fact, take place, and determine that Landis was one of the agents asked to appear in the movie by its director, none other than Jackie, his boss. Hammersmith Farm sits on 97 acres overlooking Narragansett Bay. The estate had been the young Jackie's summer home, inherited by her stepfather, Hugh D. Auchincloss, Jr., who had married Jackie's mother, Janet Lee, in 1942, after her divorce from Jackie's father, John Blackjack Bouvier. A decade later, in 1953, after the newly elected Senator Kennedy proposed to Jackie, the two were married nearby in Newport's St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church. A huge reception followed at Hammersmith Farm, with more than 1,200 in attendance. The guests mingled among tables set up under tents and umbrellas. The backdrop was the family's 28-room mansion on the sprawling lawn that gently sloped down to the bay. Jackie was enamored of the arts, especially the visual arts. While in college, she had attended Smith's junior year study abroad program in post-war Paris. She then returned stateside to finish classes and eventually landed a job as a journalist and photographer for Washington, D.C.'s Times Herald. She became taken with all things French, harboring a fascination with experimental film. She often expressed an interest in someday directing a movie. It was during her time as a photojournalist that she began dating her husband-to-be. While JFK was in office, the Auchincloss residence would become a favorite retreat. Typically less hectic and crowded than the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport, and along with the ever-present still cameras belonging to the official White House photographers, a movie camera was often on hand. As the home movies at the JFK Library show, the first family would swim in the pool at nearby Bailey's Beach Club, play in the sand on its restricted beach, and regularly take afternoon cruises on the Honey Fitz, named for Kennedy's maternal grandfather, John Francis Fitzgerald, a one-time mayor of Boston and congressman. September 21st to 22nd, 1963, would be JFK's last visit to Hammersmith Farm. During our talks, Landis would occasionally refer to those 48 hours. More recently, after I pressed him to open up further, his recollections came into focus. He recalls that the First Lady had made an unusual request. She explained that she and the President were making a humorous short film, a kind of spy movie, and she asked if the agents wouldn't mind participating. I came to learn that Landis had been accompanied by 8 colleagues, including Roy Kellerman, who would later be in charge of the agents in Dallas, riding in the presidential limousine in the front passenger seat. At one point, according to Landis, Jackie asked the agents to hurriedly drive up to the main house and react as if they had just heard shots. Landis says the agents entered the house and found the president lying on the floor in the foyer with ketchup smeared on him. Jackie sat up on the staircase, directing the action from the very spot where she and JFK had been photographed on their wedding day 10 years earlier. Landis understood it was a prank and thought it odd but typical of the mischievous, playful atmosphere the first couple sanctioned when outside of public view. Everyone applauded and laughed when the filming was complete, Landis recalls. But given the events 2 months later, the concocted scenario would soon take on a dark significance and is only rarely mentioned in Kennedy's histories. The murder, The murder, meant as a kind of goof, more on this below, actually raises questions of warning signs that the president may have ignored. The well-known Kennedy competitive drive and the president's willingness to take physical risk place a spotlight on the issue of whether JFK was acting recklessly by insisting that he ride in an open car in the Dallas motorcade, without its bubble top covering, and with his Secret Service agents admonished to stay off the running board on the rear of the limousine, lest they get between the president and the public. What's more, there were concerns among the staff and outside observers that JFK was playing fast and loose in his off hours, acting with abandon in his romantic liaisons, staying up late with hard-partying family members, and sometimes going to extremes with close friends. It was not unusual, for example, for JFK to horse around with Red Fay, who agreed to appear in the film. The pair had known each other since World War II, when both men were injured and recuperating at a South Pacific naval base. Their bond became lifelong. The Fays were frequent guests of the Kennedys, especially on long weekends. Jack and Red would often trade jokes, playing touch football and tennis, and socializing. In a rare comment Fay made about the movie 20 years after the fact, he claimed it was all in jest. "We were bored," he said, "and we decided to put the photographer to good use." In what now appears to be an attempt to protect his fallen friend, Fay insisted that he was the only victim in the movie, but that is belied by the accounts of Landis and photographer Knudsen, who remember JFK and Fay taking turns being a casualty. In 1943, the president, then a Navy lieutenant fighting in the Pacific Theater, narrowly escaped death when a Japanese destroyer rammed his boat PT-109, cutting it in two. During his childhood and as an adult, he endured other near-death experiences, receiving last rites several times. As a result, JFK reportedly maintained a healthy skepticism about whether he would ever grow old. His family, according to the well-worn myth, was laboring under an Irish curse. In August 1944, his older brother Joe, whom the family patriarch Joseph P. Kennedy Sr. had hoped might become president one day, died after volunteering for a daring bombing mission. 4 years later, Kathleen Kick Kennedy Cavendish, a younger, vibrant sister and one of JFK's closest siblings, died in a tragic plane crash in France. Irish lore contains tales of uncanny premonitions, though descendants of the Emerald Isle claim no monopoly on such experiences. Colm Keane, the Irish author and broadcaster, wrote an intriguing book in 2011 entitled Forewarned, Extraordinary Irish Stories of Premonitions and Dreams, in which he observed, apropos of his writing numerous books about death and dying, "It gradually came to my attention that some of those returning from near-death journeys found they had developed a keen ability to foresee happenings that had yet to take place." When reports of the home movie emerged in 1983 with the publication of Ralph Martin's JFK biography, A Hero for Our Time, then-Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, an assistant secretary of labor in the Kennedy administration, remarked, "He was Irish. You can't be Irish without knowing that eventually the world is going to break your heart." Kennedy had such forebodings about his own early death. Following his assassination, some of his friends and family came forward with stories of JFK's preoccupation with assassination. Thurston Clark, in JFK's Last 100 Days, catalogued Kennedy's statements on the topic. One example, when he arrived at the gates of the American ambassador's residence in Dublin, Clark recounted of the president's June 1963 trip to Ireland, a cheering mob surrounded his limousine and forced him to walk. "Crowds don't threaten me," he told the ambassador. "It's that fellow standing on the roof with a gun that I worry about." Clark also pointed out that Kennedy spent time studying Lincoln. when Jim Bishop, a journalist and syndicated columnist, interviewed Kennedy in late October 1963 to write about a day in the life of the president, Kennedy spent considerable time questioning Bishop about his book, The Day Lincoln Was Shot, a minute-by-minute account of April 14, 1865. "My feelings about assassination are identical with Mr. Lincoln's," Kennedy told Bishop. "Anyone who wants to exchange his life for mine can take it. They just can't protect me that much." Of course, the most oft-quoted example of Kennedy's fixation on the subject came the morning of November 22, 1963, at the Hotel Texas in Fort Worth. As Jackie would later confide to historian William Manchester for his best-selling chronicle, The Death of a President, her husband casually told her and others that day, "You know, last night would have been a hell of a night to assassinate a president. I mean it. There was the rain and the night, and we were all getting jostled. Suppose a man had a pistol in a briefcase. Then he could have dropped the gun in the briefcase and melted away in the crowd." Next photos, roll 'em. This photo by an unknown photographer shows the First Lady on a Newport dock, evidently directing Knudsen with 16mm camera as he filmed a prank movie that would include two scenes in which her husband is shot. Caroline Kennedy is obscured below Knudsen. Standing next to a young family friend, Marc Antonio Crispi, the president appears to use a towel to wipe fake blood off his shirt. A print of the image was given to Knudsen the next day. A sequence in the spy movie depicts Paul Red Fay, JFK's wartime pal and undersecretary of the Navy, with a rope around his neck, his lips and shoulder bloodied by ketchup. In the late spring and summer of 63, Kennedy was in the midst of the most transformative time of his administration. In June alone, he began to consider or implement initiatives on everything from U.S. relations with the Soviet Union to civil rights, to the vexing question of whether to withdraw U.S. advisors from Vietnam. He delivered his famous world peace speech, in which he called for not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women, not merely peace in our time, but peace for all time. To top it off, that month, the book about Kennedy's naval ordeal, PT-109, was made into a major motion picture, with Hollywood heavyweight Cliff Robertson portraying a heroic Lieutenant Kennedy. As the summer progressed, the U.S. and USSR arrived at a momentous Cold War crossroads, signing a limited nuclear test ban treaty, a move JFK hoped would lead to complete nuclear disarmament. There was the inkling of a shift toward détente with the Soviets, a hoped-for tamping down of tensions between the superpowers. In September, Kennedy even proposed a U.S.-Soviet lunar expedition. In essence, the president was addressing not just the geopolitical moment, but the larger question of the survival of the human race in the nuclear age. And this impulse to possibly realign national security priorities rubbed many elites in the state and defense establishment, not to mention the CIA, the wrong way. Others also held their own potential vendettas against Kennedy, including operatives in Russia. Heads of the Italian-American Mafia, then under investigation by JFK and his attorney general brother, Robert Kennedy, and Cuban leader Fidel Castro, who had been the target of unsuccessful U.S. assassination plots. Many observers, historians, and conspiracy theorists alike believe that dark forces may well have begun to coalesce around the idea of JFK's removal from command. But let's return for a moment to June. On the 11th, Kennedy went on national television to plead for racial peace and justice following the obstruction of desegregation efforts at the University of Alabama by Governor George Wallace. This was a dramatic and controversial change to John and Robert Kennedy's previously cautious approach to civil rights. The pair understood that Democrats at the time held national office only by the favor of voters in the solidly Democratic South. Kennedy asked Americans to examine their consciences and consider new legislation, which, after his death, would become the historic Civil Rights Act of 1964. As if to underscore the seriousness of the threats to African Americans, later that night, the NAACP's Medgar Evers was gunned down by a sniper with a scope. 11 days later, JFK flew to Europe. In West Berlin, he delivered one of the most majestic pronouncements of his presidency, speaking to cheering throngs gathered in front of the city hall of the divided city. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is Ich bin ein Berliner. From Germany, Kennedy flew to Ireland to visit the homeland of his ancestors. It was a highly sentimental time, with adoring crowds crushing around him. "These were the three happiest days I've ever spent in my life," he privately told one of his hosts just before departing. He continued on to Italy, making his way to the Vatican for an audience with the recently installed Pope Paul VI. By July 4th, JFK was ensconced in Hyannisport, basking in the accomplishments of a marathon month. But then, quite dramatically, the energy began to shift. On August 7th, the First Lady decided to accompany her 5-year-old daughter, Caroline, to horseback riding lessons at Allen Farm in Osterville, 6 miles west of Hyannisport. Jackie was 8 months pregnant and had limited her activities. She had a history of difficult pregnancies, including a miscarriage, a stillbirth, and her son John F. Kennedy Jr.'s premature birth. Landis noticed Jackie walking toward him with deliberation shortly after their arrival. She said they had to leave immediately, but asked him not to interrupt Caroline's lesson. Landis drove her back to Hyannis, a bumpy ride. Then a helicopter transported both of them to the military hospital at Otis Air Force Base, where doctors performed a cesarean birth. The baby boy, Patrick, was 5.5 weeks premature, his lungs not fully developed. After being taken to a Boston hospital, Patrick died on August 9th, in a high-pressure hyperbaric chamber as the president held his tiny hand. JFK's desperate prayers for the life of his second son echoed his own father's prayers for him when he was just 2 and hospitalized in Boston with scarlet fever, his temperature spiking to 105. Through his grief, might Kennedy have wondered if Patrick's death presaged his own? At the very least, the president was forced to intensify his focus on his life's priorities. What is certain is that his behavior changed. He renewed his close relationship with Jackie and, according to biographer Clark, ceased his rampant womanizing. Knowing that Jackie had suffered from severe postpartum depression in the past, Kennedy was determined to keep her spirits up. "You know, Jackie," he said, "we must not create an atmosphere of sadness in the White House, because this would not be good for anyone, not for the country, and not for the work we have to do." Clark observed, "His reference to the work we have to do stressed their partnership in a way that Jackie had defined gratifying and promising. According to her mother, it made a profound impression on her." Realizing that Jackie needed some time to get away and process her grief, her sister, Lee Radziwill, asked her to come along on a trip to Greece a few weeks later. Though JFK at first had been concerned about the optics of such a trip, especially since Radziwill reputedly was having an affair with Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis, Jackie would marry Onassis in 1968, Kennedy, at his wife's insistence, eventually relented. In October, the sisters departed, accompanied by agents Landis and Clint Hill. While in Greece, says Landis, Jackie confided that she would soon join her husband on a domestic political trip, something she had mostly avoided. Landis understood the First Lady's decision. He, too, recognized a reinvigorated bond between the two, sensing that they were determined to spend more time together. It was during this period of trying to lighten the mood that the President and First Lady came up with the idea of a home movie. JFK was clowning with Faye. Jackie had her interest in photography and directing, and JFK loved the James Bond books, as well as movies in general. He had spent time in Hollywood, where his father had run three film studios. Kennedy even thought of writing his own spy novels. JFK's interest in 007 author Ian Fleming had begun in 1954 when he read Casino Royale while recovering from back surgery. He met privately with Fleming during the 1960 campaign. A year later, when Time Life correspondent Hugh Seide wrote about the new president's reading habits, Kennedy praised Fleming's work. Like many of the world's leaders, Seide noted, he has a weakness for detective stories, especially those of British author Ian Fleming and his fictitious undercover man James Bond. At the time, Bond thrillers were only beginning to catch on in America, but with Kennedy's endorsement, sales soared. The first 007 movie, Dr. No, hit U.S. theaters in May 1963. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.